Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The 2019 Summer Sunday Lecture Series, celebrating the old master collections of the National Gallery of Art, takes a closer look at the many treasures housed in the gallery's permanent collection. Works by Italian, French, Dutch, and American artists are featured in this visual tour. New insights and surprising discoveries await, featuring gallery favorites and recently acquired works. In this second lecture in the series, presented on July 21st, senior lecturer Eric Denker discusses the gallery's collection of Venetian painting. The holdings include rare works by Giovanni Bellini, such as his late masterpiece, The Feast of the Gods, as well as works by the most important artists to emerge from Bellini's studio, including Giorgione, Titian, and Carpaccio. Also well represented in the gallery's remarkable collection are Venetian paintings from the second half of the 16th century by Tintoretto and Veronese, and the 18th century by Giovanni Battista Tiepolo and Canaletto.
Good afternoon and welcome to the East Building Auditorium for this Sunday's 2 o'clock lecture, Venetian painting from 1400 to 1800 in the collection of the National Gallery of Art. I'm Eric Denker with the staff of the Education Division, and this is the second in 7 lectures on the permanent collections of the West Building. Last summer, we had David Gariff do a series of lectures on the collections here in the East Building, and so to balance our coverage of the collections, we wanted to address some of the aspects of the collections in the original building of the National Gallery. Our subject today has to do with Venice. And Venice, by 1500, when this bird's eye view was made, was the single most powerful, most affluent, and most cosmopolitan of all the states of Europe. That wealth and power was based on being one of the major maritime powers in the history of Europe. It involved trade through the Middle East and beyond, and involved the portal to Europe for many of the goods that came from Asia and from the eastern part of Europe. The image that you see here, a woodcut, one of the great technological achievements of the period, is by Jacopo da Barbari, and it was commissioned by Anton Koberger. When I say it was one of the great technological achievements, that is because it is made up of 6 sheets. It is 4.5 feet high and 9 feet wide. And special presses had to be made to accommodate blocks that were to be this size. Paper, unusually large, had to be produced. And it was done at a time when it was clear that the image of Venice, and Venice alone, not its holdings on the mainland, would carry a great deal of the status and importance of the state at this moment. You can see by looking toward the top of the bird's eye view that there is Mercury presiding over Venice, and it says Venite MD. Sometimes when I'm lecturing in the schools, I have to ask the students not to think of it as Venice, Maryland. The MD being for 1500. And it is Mercury, and the inscription around Mercury says that it is Mercury who presides over the greatest emporium in the world. Mercury, the god of commerce. And so there is a particularly secular point of view here. And he is on axis, if you make a line straight down, with Neptune. And it is Neptune who is so important for a maritime empire. There are no references to religion on this map. There are relatively few mentions of other details. Instead, it is meant to be an up-to-date view, which could, in fact, still be used in many ways today. Venice is made up of 110 islands in a lagoon. They are connected by some 450 bridges. As you look at this image, you can see quite clearly the reverse S shape of the Grand Canal, which stretches for about 2.25 miles. And in the center there of that Grand Canal snaking through, you can see the Rialto Bridge, the only bridge that crossed the Grand Canal until the 19th century. The city is divided up into six sestieri, sixth rather than quarters. There are three on either side of the Grand Canal. Over to the left side of that S-shaped curve, those are the sestieri of Dorso Duro and of Santa Croce and of San Polo. Just above where Neptune sits, you'll see the Piazza San Marco, the political and religious center of the city, with the Doge's Palace, the Basilica, the Campanile, the bell tower, and the piazza itself. And so we have San Marco as one of the sestieri and Cannareggio. And then far off to your right, you will see the arsenal in the sestieri of Castello. The city's population at the time that this was done, approximately 110,000 people. It is remarkable not only for the layout of the city, but also for the details that it shows us of ships sitting in mudflats as the tide is out. To the lower right, you will see a regatta, and it's the first recorded use of the term regatta. So there are a lot of things to recommend us with this bird's eye point of view. What it doesn't represent is the fluorescence of culture in the 15th and 16th century that is really our object today. In Venice, we have a conservative artistic community, often looking back toward its Byzantine origins. And so mosaics are very dominant in the 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th century. We know that paintings on panels really begin in the 14th century, to some degree with Paolo Veneziano and other 14th century artists. But our collection really begins in the 15th century. And so the earliest of the artists that I want to mention here, there's a detail of the Grand Canal coming down there to the customs house, the Dogana there at the bottom. That the earliest of these paintings, which came into the collection in 1991, is a work by Jacopo Bellini. And Jacopo Bellini is the head of a family of artists. This was perhaps even more common in Venice than it was in the rest of Italy during the 15th and 16th century. Jacopo, born around 1400, was the son of a tinsmith. He developed as an artist working in egg tempera, doing altarpieces. We know that he becomes aware of the advances taking place in perspective and in the use of materials that are being explored in Tuscany and particularly in Florence. This is a relatively late work in his career. It's generally dated to 1459, and it's an image of St. Anthony Abbot and San Bernardino. Abbot in the typical costume of the time on the left, and then San Bernardino over to the right holding the globe with the name of God. As they both face inward, it is assumed, I think with good evidence, that this is the left-hand side of a triptych, so that there would have been a central panel probably with the tomb, with a scene either of resurrection or something related to the tomb, and then there would have been two saints facing it on the right. And we know that Jacopo was commissioned to work on the chapel of the Gatta Malata, the so-called honey cat, the great condottieri, the great hired mercenary in Padua, and that this was probably meant for the funerary chapel in Padua. In this, being in Padua, he is probably influenced by both Donatello, who had worked there, and also by the younger Mantegna, who would soon become a family member. The work shows two figures. They are rather columnar and stiff. The draperies give them a nice sense of three-dimensionality, but there isn't a great sense of movement, nor is there a great emotional impact. This would come a little bit later on. And it would come with his son, Giovanni, and his second son, the other son, Gentile Bellini, and part of the imagery that we'll talk about will derive from the advent of something else in Venice, and that is the arrival for a year in 1475 of Antonello da Messina. Antonello da Messina, as his name suggests, comes from Sicily, and we know that he studies in the court at Naples and that he is an early exemplar in the use of oil paints and the stylistic developments that can be associated with the more slowly drying, easily blended oil rather than egg tempera. His influence will be in both style and in format. He appears to have brought the idea of the bust-length portrait with a man's face seen in three-quarter view with him to the court, something that Bellini, Giovanni Bellini, would pick up on in his work. The work that you see here has been argued about, as many of the 15th century works in the collection, in terms of attribution. And it is thought to be by Antonello by most. Many scholars also believe that he had a hand in perhaps doing the design, but that his son or a close follower completed the painting. In either event, it's a good example of the kind of work that he produced, that three-quarter view, the head in this case turned slightly, the hair characteristic of the time, and the kind of costume that we expect from the 1470s as well. The hair may seem slightly artificial in comparison to some of the other works, and yet this sculpture is in the Courier Museum in Venice, and I think it shows that this was, in fact, a popular way of wearing one's hair at this moment. I think perhaps it is even the same person, although we can't identify him. What the Mantegnas will lead to is a whole series of portraits that we have in the collection by Bellini and the Circle of Bellini. Here are two good examples. And as you look at these, the one with the blue sky in the background over to your left is one that comes from the Samuel Kress collection, whereas the one on the right comes from Andrew Mellon's collection. And these are the two major figures in terms of patronage for our 15th and 16th century Italian collections. The figures are similarly bust length. They look off into the distance. They are seen in three-quarter view. And this is perhaps where they differ just a little bit from the Antonello, because Antonello has a greater psychological penetration. A recent exhibition, mainly of portraits in Milan, suggests the variety of different human expression that communicates inner emotion. And in order to do that, the figures necessarily have to look out to the viewer, whereas in most of the works by Bellini, they look off into the distance. And so there is this crucial difference between them. Even in those who are identifiable, here in the 1475 Giovanni Bellini that is of a great general and ambassador, Giovanni Emo, E-M-O. And this is done right about the time that Antonello is in Venice as well, around 1475. It's associated with a statue that's by Antonio Rizzo that is now today in Vicenza, but originally it was in Venice in the church and monastery of Santa Maria de Serve in Venice. And so the two look closely alike, and he has been identified with the ambassador's hat in this case and that magnificent brocade that you see down below as well. Here too, the attribution has sometimes been argued for Giovanni's brother Gentile, and unfortunately we have no work here by his brother Gentile for comparison's sake. I had the opportunity some years ago when we had an extensive exhibition of Venetian High Renaissance painting to take a group of Italian visitors from Padova, and there was a direct descendant who looked precisely like this in that tour. Although Giovanni Bellini was one of the major portraitists working in Venice in the latter part of the 15th century, certainly he's best known for his images of the Madonna and Child. And in this way, he forms a kind of counterpart to Raphael in Rome. There are almost limitless numbers in terms of Giovanni and Giovanni's circle. This Madonna and Child in a landscape dates to about 1480, 1485. As you look at it, it is a delicate half-length, the model being somebody that we feel that we could identify on the street, not overly idealized, but a beautiful model nonetheless. She wears the two colors that are traditional colors for the Madonna, the blue and the red, the blue for her role as the Queen of the Heavens, the red which symbolizes the later crucifixion, the blood of Christ. And she is here with the Christ child, who is on her robe and placed on a parapet, a beautifully marbled parapet. And the child looks expectantly up at her, and in his hand he appears to have what is a small apple. And that apple is a symbol of redemption, of the fall, the original apple from the fall, and then the idea of redemption through Christ. It is one of the sweeter, I think more touching images of the Madonna and Child in the collection. From relatively late in his career, we have Giovanni's image here of Saint Jerome in a landscape. But clearly, if you wanted an image of Saint Jerome, you could have made him much larger in scale in comparison to the landscape. And we know that Giovanni Bellini is one of the early artists to really become enamored of the depiction of nature, of a society who is so urban, longing for the beauty of the Veneto itself and of nature. The magnificent painting that's in the Frick collection in New York, one of the great Venetian paintings in America of St. Francis in ecstasy, shows that affection for landscape. This smaller scale work will suit our needs here as well to understand that affection, because St. Jerome, clearly identified, having a Bible in front of him, reminding us that his great accomplishment is the translation of the Bible from the Hebrew and from the Greek into the Vulgate, into the Latin. He sits on a little stone seat, and you have him sitting above a lion, and that's another of his attributes. And he's outdoors by a well, but in fact, he's not out of doors entirely. The architecture of the cave at the top tells us that he's in an interior. We are looking out from the cave, and what do we see but careful detail of nature, from the stones to the grassy knoll, to the trees and shrubs beyond, to the water, perhaps the lagoon, to an island fortress out in the lagoon, and some classical ruins as well. And there is a panoply of animals here as well, from the lizard down below, to the rabbits that are there in the center, to the raven, which sits up in the branch all the way at the top of the cave. And many of these have some symbolic value to us as well. And I call your attention particularly to those two rabbits in the center who are nuzzling. One of the aspects of St. Jerome in his own writings, his seclusion in the desert, his leaving civilization behind because of the seduction of classical literature, because of the interest in classics. He writes about how Christ appears to him in a dream and says, "You're not a Christian, you're a Ciceronian, you're interested in classical literature." So he absents himself from the great cities, and he's one of the first of the great monastic fathers. But he also describes vivid dreams, sexually charged dreams, that he has, and how he has to render his flesh with a stone to keep this kind of thought away. And so I'm suggesting here that those two rabbits represent lust, especially given that they are nuzzling each other around what are clearly fig leaves, which are references to original sin. And I don't think it's an accident that these are just in the center of the painting. At approximately the same time, he does the image that you see here, the upper of these two images. His brother-in-law, Mantegna, who we'll talk about a little bit more in a moment, had taken a commission, although he was working largely in Mantova. His brother-in-law, Mantegna, had married into the Bellini family in 1453, marrying Nicolosia, that he had done both religious works, altarpieces, prints, but also had done a number of scenes that were based on ancient history. He does, given a commission, drawings and preparations to do a set of four of these long, thin paintings. Paintings that are about 2.5 feet tall and about 12 feet wide. And the commission comes from Francesco Corner, probably for the Palazzo Corner Mocenigo. But he dies after completing only one of the four. The one that you see here on the screen, the lower one. And these are scenes, episodes from the life of Publius Cornelius Scipio, and the family was trying to establish a kind of descent from this noble Roman family. And so Bellini takes up the project and completes the project, and so we have in the National Gallery's collection this painting. And you'll see that it is done in grisaille. So it is meant to imitate stone carving against a rich stone background. It is done monochromatically, using just black and white against the richness of that red. It appears that this was the first time that Bellini had moved away from portraiture or religious painting, that this is really his first secular subject. And perhaps he and his brother-in-law had made a kind of agreement that he wouldn't indulge in the same kinds of subjects that Mantegna specialized in as well. Mantegna is responsible, we believe, for this gem in the collection, this image of Judith and Holofernes that dates to about 1495 to 1500. And this is a painting that comes to us from the Widener collection. It is typical of the work that Mantegna was doing in this period. If you look at Judith, she is very sculptural and three-dimensional. There is a very sharp edge and contour to everything here. What's the story? What episode in the story does this depict? In fact, it has to do with Judith, who is a widow and an Israelite while they're being besieged by the Assyrian general Holofernes. And as a ruse, she pretends to leave the Israelites behind, Bethulia, and she begins to spend time in the tent of the Assyrian general. And he comes home one night completely drunk, and she severs his head and puts it in a bag. And this will be shown and put the Assyrians to flight. Here she is with her servant, with the bag which had been intended to bring her food back and forth, which was different than the food that the Assyrians would eat. And so it is, in its own way, an early example of recycling. You can see the small, quasi-grotesque, almost humorous image of the foot of Holofernes there sticking up on the bed in the background, balancing the head. Mantegna is a great colorist. Notice the variations in tone on the tent, on the blue of the garment with gold highlights, on the orange that is of the servant, and down below the details of the hard edges of the stone platform that they inhabit. All of these are characteristic of Mantegna and the people who are very close to Mantegna. We've talked about Giovanni Bellini, and it is undoubtedly Giovanni Bellini who trains the vast majority of the important artists for the first half of the 16th century in Venice. And among the artists that come out of his orbit, certainly Carpaccio is one of the most charming, and we see him here in a painting that came from Andrew Mellon, the 1515 panel of the flight into Egypt. The careful attention to the detail of costume, the sense of the narrative, the landscape of the Veneto in the background, all of these are characteristic of Carpaccio at his best. And we are looking forward to having a larger display, installation of Carpaccio in future years. And here I think you can see right away his talent for evoking the detail of the costume and all of the various colors without going too deeply into the emotional state of the figures. Along with Carpaccio, another artist that comes out of the orbit of Bellini is Cima da Conigliano. Cima from the Veneto town of Conigliano. Born in 1459, he comes to Venice. We don't actually have documentation that he was in the studio, but his work carefully parallels that of Bellini. Again, hard-edged contours, figures that are carefully rendered, images of compositional harmony, of plasticity, of clear spatial arrangements, of warm color, and I think most importantly, inhabiting the landscape of the Veneto, of the area around Conigliano, today the great home of Prosecco, but in those days, the beautiful rolling hillsides leading up toward the Dolomites and the foothills of the Alp, very endearing to people living in Venice itself. Again, it reflects the influence of Bellini's work in the 70s and 80s, here with the Madonna and Child, who are seen with St. Jerome on one side and St. John the Baptist holding his reed cross on the other. You may find the long bearded man on the left in other paintings. He seems to have posed for a number of these artists, including not only Cima, but including Bellini and perhaps the young Titian as well. Cima certainly must have known Giovanni Bellini's approach to St. Jerome. St. Jerome, one of the great heroes of the humanist society of Venice and of Italy in general in the 15th and early 16th century, a man who was both devoted to religion but knowledgeable in the classics, in literature. Here, St. Jerome in the landscape from about 1500, and this from the collection of Samuel Cress. And here we see the figure of St. Jerome, and here he has the stone in his hands as he renders his flesh in this way in front of that crucifixion. But there, the blue of the Dolomites seen quite clearly in the distance. One of the magical names in the history of art, and certainly of Italian and Venetian painting, is Giorgione, whose early death left us with only a few works, only one signed, and rather difficult sometimes to date. We are enormously proud of having this Giorgione in the collection, again from the Cress family, a work dating to about 1505 to 1510, in the last few years of Giorgione's life. It is an adoration of the shepherds, and it shows us a number of elements that are noteworthy. First of all, Instead of it being an adoration of the kings, which was much more popular in the 15th century, it is an adoration of the shepherds. And the shepherds take front and center in pride of place. The Holy Family has been displaced over to the right. They are in front of a cave, and the cave is more traditionally associated with Byzantine nativities, but here, Venice, often thinking back of its Byzantine origins, has them outside of a cave with Joseph, Mary kneeling down, the Christ child on a bit of the edges of her cloak. You can see that she's still wearing the blue and red, that these would have been conventions that were widely understood. But we're brought front and center to those two peasants, to those two shepherds, and other shepherds that can be seen in the distance. And now we have another influence that is essential to understand Venetian painting in the 16th century. Leonardo has visited Venice. He must have interacted with the small artistic community, as Dürer visited and interacted with that community. It is through Leonardo that we get this sense of atmosphere, of tangible atmosphere. And you'll notice that the Madonna and St. Joseph are not hard-edged, but the edges of their garments fade slightly into the atmosphere of the cave. And we look back into the shadows of the cave and see the ox and the ass, the first witnesses of the birth of Christ, according to the New Testament narrative. And they disappear back into the mist, as do the cherubim, those winged heads that are angels back there at the top of the cave. And so one half of the composition is given over to the narrative, but not the other half. The other half is given over to an affection for nature, of water coming down, of fields in the distance, of the blue of the Dolomites. And so this is carefully balanced. It is very much a pastoral scene. I think there's something else that's interesting here. As over the last few months, we've talked about Tintoretto and the need to look at Tintoretto from particular angles, the fact that he implies certain viewpoints, that I think if you came to this painting from one side, from over to the left, that the figures would seem more toward the center, that the landscape wouldn't perhaps appear as important. And we don't know its original location, but I would suggest that it would be crucial to understand. Beyond that, I want to mention something else. As you look at the torn garments of the shepherds, and as the Christ child there on the ground next to one of the shepherd's hats, you'll notice just above the child there is a fence, a wattle fence. The wattle fence was generally used to keep the animals penned up. It could sometimes be used around the Madonna. But in this case, it has a particular function. It has nothing to do with the animals. Instead, it clearly separates Joseph from the Madonna, suggesting that he has nothing to do with the birth of this child. And I think that's crucial for us to understand as well. And there is that loving appearance of the landscape over on the left. And you can see all the way to the upper left, an angel coming down to announce to the shepherds that they should go and seek the Christ child. And so there is a bit of archaic narration, two scenes rather than simply one, within the same landscape, within the same moment. Giorgione's influence on younger artists can't be overstated. I use this example from the Accademia galleries in Venice of Col Tempo, of La Vecchietta, the older woman, to mention Giorgione's not only understanding of atmosphere, but his move away from idealization to a greater realism. This older woman, her teeth ground down, her skin stretched. She holds a banner, Col Tempo, with time, reminding us of the biblical quotation, as I am now, you will be, as you are now, I once was. That time is a great factor. Well, I think this will have an impact when we go to look at some of the other paintings that date from about this same moment. And so here, a painting that at one time was in fact attributed to Giorgione, I think for this particular reason. It is called A Portrait of a Venetian Gentleman. Although I have often thought he's not really a gentleman. His hand slams down on the book. He suggests that he's not happy, and he certainly doesn't seem to be enjoying posing for a portrait. It's a painting that recently has been reattributed to Giovanni Cariani, who was an important pupil of Bellini, who was influenced by Giorgione and Titian, who comes to Venice and does this painting probably around 1510. As you look at the Cariani here, it's had a number of major changes. It has pentimenti, where the artist repented and made changes. And so clearly, from looking at the entire painting there on the left, you can see that the wall has been built up, that the wall was originally lower. What you can't see, that x-rays revealed to us, is that originally the figure held a sword hilt in his hand before there was a book. And that must have seemed particularly aggressive. And so that was taken out. The book was placed there so that his hand rested, and initially there was something else in his hand. And that's why I have reproduced the detail on the right, because you can see, if you look carefully, that originally that hand held a dagger. And the dagger was painted out. And instead, this bit of cloth, which I think is a purse, and is deliberately below that window, which is a view of the Ducal Palace in Venice, on an angle that would suggest that it's being done from the customs house, indicating that this is a merchant that has business with the Ducal Palace and with the government. Cariani was represented in the collection by other paintings before this one was attributed. The VVO probably suggests that the painting was done from life. Giorgione's influence and the early Titian's influence can be seen in other works, including this work by Sebastiano del Piombo. And this is a portrait of a woman as a wise virgin. It dates from about the same time, about 1510, and comes to us from the Kress collection. We know that Sebastiano del Piombo was trained by Bellini, and yet he is clearly influenced by the young Giorgione in the way the figure emerges out of shadow, surrounded by atmosphere, and to a certain extent, unidealized. I think this is one of the unsung paintings in the collection. Sebastiano, before he leaves Rome in 1511, shows the ability to convey a sense of the fabric, of the skin tones, of the animation of this figure, both statuesque and sensual. And we are blessed to have this painting, also by Sebastiano del Piombo, of the period after he goes to Rome, of Cardinal Bandinello Salli, his secretary and two geographers, painting that is dated to 1516, painting that shows the interaction of these various figures and shows Sebastiano, I think, at his best, both as a portraitist and as a painter of decorative objects as well, from the bell to the geography book, the maps, to that marvelous carpet on the table, to the detail of the cartolino, of the piece of paper to the lower right-hand corner, to the illusionistic fly that walks as if on the surface of the painting. Countless visitors have reported to us that there is a fly walking on our painting. And there you can see it. It is trompe l'oeil. It is meant to fool the eye. It's a kind of intellectual game. And it takes all of us in the first time we see it. We look closely, thinking that it's just a fly on the surface of the painting, or perhaps on his leg. It's a little bit of that inventiveness and that imagination for which we prize Renaissance painting so much. I thought this would make a nice comparison. This is the second Cariani that I wanted to show you, the concert from a little bit later, from 1518, 1520. As you look, the characterization of the three figures, very individualized, not meant to be idealized in any way. The figure in the center of the lute player, perhaps with his pupil over to our right, and his tutor over here to the left, suggesting the importance of art as part of the education. There is, I think, an incisive talent in the ability to render that hat, the fur, the instrument, the little box that held extra strings for the lute, or even the rag where the lutist would have to dry his fingers every so often, in a marvelous conceit. So all of these are aspects of Cariani, who is not really sufficiently well known today. From the same decade, one of, I think, the most significant of the painter's paintings that's in the permanent collection. It is this image, comes to us from the Widener family. It is of the Feast of the Gods. As so many images derive from this period, it comes from Ovid's work, but not in this case from Ovid's Metamorphosis, which is a kind of treasure trove of stories for Italian painters who want to demonstrate their erudition and patrons who want to give that same idea. In this case, it's from Ovid's Fasti. And this was commissioned very late in life, well, probably into his 80s, from Giovanni Bellini. And it was commissioned for the court in Ferrara by Alfonso d'Este for his Camerino d'Alabastro, his alabaster room. It held his great treasures, wonderful rocks, marvelous examples of sculpture, great paintings from around the peninsula. And so he begins to work on this large painting, which is some five and a half feet tall and about a little over 6 feet wide. He begins, and the Fasti, the feasts, are explanations of Roman holidays. In this case, it is the explanation of Febralia, of this great celebration toward the end of the year, toward the end of February. And the story has to do with Thebes and the celebration in Thebes. And partway through the commission, he is asked to make it into a feast of the gods. And so by necessity, he has to put in attributes. So reading from left to right, we see a satyr next to Silenus and his donkey with the young Bacchus pouring wine there in blue. Beyond, seated on the ground, with the helmet and the caduceus, Mercury. Next to him, Jupiter with his eagle. Beyond that, Neptune with his trident on the ground. Apollo with the viola da braccio held all the way over beneath the legs of Priapus, the Roman god of procreation. And then the nymph, Lotus, all the way over there on the right. The story goes that after a long night of partying, that early in the morning, Priapus develops a lust for the woodland nymph who's fallen asleep all the way over there in the corner on the right, and that he is shown beginning to lift her drapery. He's shown in an advanced state of excitement. I am a federal employee after all. And that just at that moment, the donkey brays and wakes everyone up. He's furious. She runs off, and Priapus demands the sacrifice of the donkey, explaining why on the feast day of Priapus, a donkey is sacrificed. Shakespeare makes allusions to this in Julius Caesar. And so it explains one of these fees. But you're not seeing it today as it was originally intended, because we know that 2 years later, Titian comes to the employ of Alfonso d'Este as well, and he will do a series of images based on mythological stories, and later on, he will change this painting. And so here is a digital reconstruction of what it probably looked like when it was first done. And in a way, we get that sense of the sun just coming up through this group of trees. In another way, it seems rather busy to us once we're used to that background. I am at, I think, some need to also give thanks here to David Brown, whose new book this will be in, on Giovanni Bellini, The Last Works. And David Brown is our longtime curator of Renaissance painting. And David has done really substantial research to establish the origins and the development of this painting. And so here you see those figures, and you can see their attributes a little more clearly. And you can see how all of those figures on the left are now silhouetted against that great hill. And that hill is the product of Titian's revision. So Titian begins to work for Alfonso d'Este, does a series of paintings that include this painting. This is the Bacchanal of the Andrians, Bacchus arriving on the island of the Andrians. And you can see its rich coloristic effects and expression with formal elegance. This is Titian responding to Bellini, now assuming the role of Bellini as the most important master in Venice. And in Venice, often there is this rivalry. Even after an artist is gone, there is, it seems, a rivalry with the remaining works of that master in trying to outdo and surpass that master. And so the painting that you see here on the left was meant to go with the Feast of the Gods. Today, this is a painting that is in the Prado, along with a third work that comes from the Camerino d'Alabastro. And you can see how the landscape now meets between the two. And Titian uses a kind of Giorgione-esque landscape, much more atmospheric, much more painterly, to set off those figures as opposed to the way they looked in front of that screen of trees. And not only does he connect the landscape, but I would suggest that in that voluptuous nude on the lower right side of the Andrians, he is showing Bellini what a voluptuous nude should look like, as opposed to the figure of Lotus that simply leaned against the tree on the lower right of the Bellini, that this sense of rivalry exists. The other painting from this sequence, actually also in the Prado, is this painting, The Worship of Venus, this 6-foot square painting, which is based on a description that Titian would have known by the ancient philosopher Philostratus of Putti, who were gathering apples in front of Venus. I think, in fact, without spending too much time here because it's not in our collection, it is Titian's celebration of children, of them pushing and pinching and playing and seeming to look out mock embarrassed at us watching all of that activity. And it is really stunning to see in person in Madrid. But here we have some of Titian's great portraits. And so we have this work of Doge Andrea Gritti from 1546 to perhaps 1550, a painting with a noble provenance, a noble history, at one time owned by King Charles I in England from 1626 until his death. It is an image of strength, Doge Andrea Gritti, that powerful countenance, staring out, the ducal robe with the great hollow decorative balds on it. That strong hand sweeping up his drapery as he strides forward. Now, this is a posthumous portrait, but it is meant to convey all the power and majesty that the Doge had at the time. We know that Titian had only recently returned from Rome. In Rome, he had seen the work of Michelangelo and met with Michelangelo. And I would suggest that that very strong visage and that hand gathering up the material are responses to him seeing the Moses, and that strong hand intertwined in Moses' beard and that great glare of Moses' face, that sense of terribilità. Vasari tells us that Titian and Michelangelo met. They admired one another and their works. But Vasari also tells us that after Titian leaves, that Michelangelo says, "Titian is a great painter. It's too bad he never learned to draw." The comparison here being the idea of Florentine artists who specialize in disegno, in drawing, as opposed to the color and mass that is used, light and shadow, to depict form in Venetian painting. Well, we are very pleased that we have not only the painting of Doge Andrea Gritti, but this image from slightly earlier of Ranuccio Farnese, who is the 12-year-old nephew of Pope Paul III. Grandson of Pope Paul III, who already at the age of 12 had been made an officer, the priore of the Knights of Malta over their property in Venice. Titian here struggled to give a 12-year-old the stature of a serious adult, as befits his role. By 14, he was the Archbishop of Naples. He was the bishop later of Bologna, of Milan, of Ravenna. He died by the age of 35. But clearly, Titian wants to capture a boy in the role of a man. He gives him this cloak, but it's oversized. He restrains himself to the use of black and white and a little bit of rose color. And that rose color comes from painting the vestment white and then by a series of glazes until it seems to glow as it rivals the satin of the cross of Malta on the robe. It is, I think, one of the most important images of childhood seeking adulthood that we have in the 16th century. Titian returned to mythological subjects here from the Mellon collection, the painting of Venus in the mirror with these two cupids holding up the mirror as she admires herself in the mirror, but not just looking at herself. The mirror is at an angle. As she looks toward the mirror, she looks at us. And so we're caught looking at her. Titian's opulent use of flesh, his magnificent sense of the materials, Italians would say, che roba, what materials these are, what stuff, the fur, the satin, the silk, and the way in which the figure emerges out. And we look back to Titian as one of the great originators of the images of Venus that then come down to us through the centuries. Venus and Adonis, one of a number of versions that he did, based on the story of Venus and Adonis from Ovid's Metamorphoses from Book 10. Here, Venus pleads with Adonis not to go off on the hunt. She knows that he will be injured. She knows that he'll be gored. And there's a sense of the ominous light off there in the distance, the dogs already sensing the kind of disaster to come. The richness, the fullness of these figures, the rounding of these forms, and Titian's particular ability to capture the human figure in motion, all characterize this work. Just now, we are putting this painting back up on the ground floor, on the ceiling, because it was painted for the Scuola San Giovanni Evangelista. It is of St. John on Patmos. It is meant to be viewed from below looking up, Di Sotto in Su, from below looking up, as we look past the figures toward the sky above. It is interesting to note this painting because it was almost undoubtedly the inspiration for the San Rocco in Glory that we've discussed so much in terms of the Tintoretto exhibition more recently. And so on to Tintoretto. And this painting was in the first room of the Tintoretto exhibition. It's an early painting of about 1544, The Conversion of Saul. And I wanted to show you this painting just after we looked at Titian's work. The story of the conversion of Saul, Why Do You Pursue Me, Saul, from Acts 9, lines 3 to 7, is a story that parallels the idea of the victory of the church over their adversaries. It was a popular story at the time. Michelangelo had done drawings of it, but here it's combined with another scene. So when you look to the right, you'll see there's a bridge and there's a horseman on that bridge. So while there is inspiration from central Italian art, Tintoretto, perhaps recently out of Titian's studio, would have been aware of a painting now gone, destroyed in the fire in the Doge's palace in 1577, a painting for the Battle of Spoleto. And this is the preparatory drawing that represents what it looked like. And we can see the figures on the bridge. And this is Titian. And so we can see that common theme, the idea of taking the drawing of Michelangelo and the painting of Titian, comes together in a number of those early works, as I've discussed at some length in the four lectures that we did on Tintoretto in context. A place where we would have discussed this painting as well from the permanent collection. Doge Alvise Mocenigo and the Dogaressa Loredana shown here. And we were pleased that we were able to have the separate portrait of his brother Giovanni, the figure that you see here on the extreme left. And here, Alvise, the Doge from 1570 to 77, a crucial time in Venetian history, and his wife Loredana pay homage, devotional attention to the Madonna and Child and those angels that you see on either side, those music-making angels. The two figures to the extreme right are, in fact, the children of Giovanni, because this is not simply a group portrait, but a dynastic portrait. It suggests to us that since the Doge Alvise and Loredana had no children, that his wealth and his interest in the family firm would go through Giovanni to his children, Marco and Alvisetti, over there on the right. And there are the two brothers, Giovanni and Alvise. Alvise kneeling down with the Doge's corno on, with that magnificent ermine cloak and the lynx that forms the fur, which is the lining of both of those garments. In fact, if we look very clearly, we can see that this is perhaps not the first version of the painting. Because in fact, Giovanni's head, the heads of the two sons, and the upper part of Loredana were all cut out of another canvas. They were then adhered to this canvas, and perhaps the earlier canvas had been damaged either by fire or water, and they hoped to save these images. And so these are patches, if you will, of both the boys' heads and of Loredana. And I hope that you'll take a good close look to be able to see how they've been applied to the canvas. In the exhibition, they were adjacent to this image. We don't know the identity of this figure, but it certainly is a figure of authority and grandeur. It is one of Tintoretto's most impressive displays of portraiture, of this figure engulfed in these robes with the beautiful lynx linings, towering up above us. Generally, he was more in favor of a half length. Here we get an almost full length figure of a type that wouldn't have been the normal format in an official portrait. So this is probably something done for somebody for their private palace, where people would come, admire it, understand the social standing of the sitter, but not simply display it in the public. Generally speaking, we would talk about El Greco as a Spanish artist, but in fact, he's born on Crete, while Crete is part of the Venetian Empire. And he comes to Venice, relearns his art, 1567 to 70, and it's undoubtedly true that he is much influenced by Tintoretto and to a lesser extent by Veronese. And you can see that in this painting of Christ cleansing the temple. The architecture, very much the kind of Palladian classical architecture that was being done in Venice at the time and being rendered by Veronese. And the colors and the way in which the paint is used, very much similar to Tintoretto. And it's not completely out of the question that he was in Tintoretto's workshop for a little while at this moment. Some years ago, if you'd come to the gallery, this would have been identified also as Tintoretto. Now it's thought of as Circle of Tintoretto, perhaps one of his pupils, Lambert Sustris, a Dutch artist, working with him. This scene from the Gospel of St. John. And you can see that even this has a certain element in the rapidity of the brushwork, the bravura quality, that it was attributed in the early 20th century to El Greco. The last of the great 16th century artists that we need to mention here is Veronese. We have a nice collection of Veronese from this melon work from 1481-82 that shows the finding of Moses. Veronese, notable for his ability to render the most beautiful ornate fabrics and costumes that the Venetian nobility in fact wore. We can see that here. And it's in contrast to this image of St. Jerome. And here, St. Jerome really does dominate the composition. The Bible open, a crucifix on the Bible. You'll notice that it's leaned, I think this is a very clever addition, it's leaned on a skull. And just beyond St. Jerome's wrist, an hourglass. The idea that life is ephemeral, that the afterlife is eternal, a kind of vanitas. And we see the rugged body of the saint, and that red robe, which is associated with cardinals, because it was thought that he had been a cardinal. But what does he hold in the other hand? One hand holds the book up, but the other hand holds a rock. Again, an allusion to these erotically charged dreams that he had had. The most recent Veronese, now 30 years ago, to come into the collection, The Last Communion of St. Lucy. And I think it is the work that shows best both a very emotional response, and we're talking about counter-reformation times, and also the kind of architecture that Veronese was capable of even on this slightly smaller scale. And this is done no more than 2 or 3 years before his death at the age of 60 in 1588. With the death of Veronese and Tintoretto within 6 years, we generally date the end of the golden age of the High Renaissance in Venice. There are artists who continue in the scope of Tintoretto's work. Certainly this artist, Palma Giovine, who worked with Tintoretto in the Doge's Palace and then continued to do Renaissance painting even into the 17th century. Here with this image of the Lamentation over the dead Christ, done in around 1620. But largely in Venice, 17th century painting was dominated by foreigners, by Johann Loth and by Benkovich and others. It wasn't until the very end of the 17th century that there is one last great flowering of Venetian art. And as I started the 15th and 16th century by Jacopo da Barbari, I wanted to start by looking at the Ludovico Ughi map of 1729 with inserts of important places in Venice along the outside that include works by Carlo Varis and Canaletto and others showing these important places. The idea of view painting derives from a Dutchman, Gaspar van Vittel, who comes down to Rome and does views of Rome, and then comes up to Venice around the latter part of the 1690s. By this time, he's changed his name to Van Vitelli and becomes a major influence on Venetian vedute view painters. And the first of these view painters that we will see is not the earliest Venetian, that would be Carlo Varis, but we have no Carlo Varis paintings. And so I'm going to center on Canaletto and his contemporaries for the last part of the lecture. This is a view of the Piazza San Marco. It shows from left to right the Basilica of San Marco, consecrated in 1090, the Doge's Palace there in the center in the pink and white marble. Over to the right, the guardhouse by Sansovino. And just along the edge of the painting, you can see the campanile, the bell tower. And it is that bell tower that's responsible for the shadow that crosses the scene that tells us that it is a specific time of day. The long shadows would say it is late afternoon. As you look at the painting, a variety of activity, including the merchants who are closing up their shops. In the distance, a Dominican preaching in front of the Doge's palace. The dentist, all the way over here to the right, that large tooth with a smaller tooth hanging from it, where there was a dental office, and dentistry was practiced during the daytime, but not into the evening. These are elements that suggest to us that Canaletto made drawings and that these are accurate views. But these are views that were actually done for the grand tourists who were coming to Italy at the time, for British and French aristocrats completing their education by going to Rome, by going to Naples, by going to Florence, and going to Venice. And yet, the evidence belies the truth of the scene, because in fact, this is the one preparatory drawing we have. And I want you to notice the relationship of the Basilica and the Doge's Palace and where those three flagpoles come in, those flagpoles which date to about 1500, because their angle will help tell us exactly where Canaletto was when he did the drawing. And so you can see those flagpoles in this photograph precisely at the same point they were in the drawing. And you will notice that you cannot, in fact, see the lagoon. You can't see the Bacino. It's covered by not only the Campanile, but by the Sansovino guardhouse. And so, in fact, these views are often composite views. The artist takes artistic liberty, knowing that they can be assured that when the painting arrives in England or in France, nobody will have Google Maps to compare it to. Nobody will have views that will show. Instead, it answers the possibility that they remember being in the piazza, remember seeing the water beyond, even if it wasn't consistent from that one spot. It is paired with this painting, and these two paintings were given to us back in 1945 by Barbara Hutton. Barbara Hutton had the Woolworth heiress, actually owned a small building just to the right of the arches, just to the left of the arches in this painting, the former Abbey of San Gregorio. She owned that and gave it to Cary Grant when she married Cary Grant in 1942 as a wedding gift. They were divorced in 1945, at which point we received the paintings. Perhaps it was a painful reminder of this gift that she no longer wanted to have around the house. This view continues the architecture, the panoply of architecture, including the salute that you see here, the great dome of the votive church of Longena. You'll notice that there is a large ship with the British Union Jack here in the harbor, a reminder about who the patrons are for these paintings. Guardi, perhaps Canaletto's greatest follower, similarly took liberties, although we have the Rialto Bridge here. In fact, the two banks should be parallel. The one on the left, where traditionally wine was delivered, the one on the right, the Rive del Carbon, where coal was delivered, they are parallel. Here they're splayed out so that pictorially they form orthogonals that lead us to the Rialto Bridge, which is made even a little bit thinner than it actually is. He used the same strategy on the Cannareggio Canal with the Tre Archi, this bridge which had only recently been renovated, because the banks on either side of this canal should also be parallel, and they are splayed quite wide for pictorial purposes. From the 18th century, we also have the greatest of the figural painters, in many ways the greatest follower of Veronese. That includes the work of Giovanni Battista Tiepolo, seen here in the relatively early Bacchus and Ariadne, only recently cleaned, on display in Lobby B. It had been overpainted, all of these architectural elements had been overpainted because they fit in with the original architecture, and once it was no longer in place, somebody felt the need to cover these over. We have now exposed them for the first time, probably in the last 200 years. And you can see Bacchus and Ariadne in all its original luster in Lobby B. We have a fine collection of works by Giovanni Battista Tiepolo and his son Domenico. Here, the Apollo and Daphne of 1755, one of, I think, the foremost mythological paintings in the collection, Apollo as he chases Daphne, the daughter of Peneus, the river god, shown with his jug, the origins of a river. And as he closes in on her, as she asks to be saved, and he has her turned into a tree. The laurel leaves will become Apollo's mark. He already has them here, perhaps something of an anomaly. And Tiepolo pictures this as having taken place in the nearby Dolomites. We have a number of significant examples, including this Modello, the largest of the 18th century models for paintings here for the ceiling of the Great Palace in Madrid, after Tiepolo had gone for the last 8 years of his life to work for Spanish patrons. And here, wealth and benefits of the Spanish monarchy under Charles III, done in 1762, just prior to leaving. You won't have had the chance to compare these two paintings, but they're here in the collection. They are both considered to be by Giovanni Battista Tiepolo, the Madonna and Child of the Goldfinch. Well, two slightly different solutions. One with the child holding on to a little string connecting down to control the goldfinch. The goldfinch thought to be a symbol of charity because it ate thorns. It plucked the thorns out of the crown of thorns. It's symbolic of a later episode of Christ's life. In the other, he holds on to his mother's cowl and holds the bird in the other hand. Just two different solutions, but interesting nonetheless. And finally, one painting that he did of a figure, a painting that underwent some change as it was painted. Because while we see it this way today, the girl with the fan, dressed in carnival costume, X-rays reveal that originally the fan was open, giving a very different message. What I've tried to do in the brief time that we've had together is to talk about some of the highlights of the Venetian painting collection. I am closing with this work by Bernardo Bellotto, Canaletto's nephew, of the Campo San Giovanni e Paolo, with the great statue that you see there of the General Colleone, done by Verrocchio. It is both a reminder to me to mention that over the next several weeks, you'll have the opportunity to hear about masterpieces in the collection of American art and of British art, also in the holdings of the National Gallery. Thanks so much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.